This week on RSBNB Update, we complete our third archaeology lore rundown, this time covering Everlight. We cover the site's history, cultural impacts, and the mysteries that bind it together. Then, the hindsight is 1820 as we head on through bugbears, churning butter, and flying planes. This is RSBNB Update, episode 793, recorded Thursday, September 3rd, 2020. World Guardians, big day out. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. This week, we're back in our full technological capacity as we have not been in the last 2 weeks. I feel good about that, and this week's a very fun episode for us. This is our third in the archaeology lore series. We're going to be talking about Everlight, of course, the Ceridoan-based dig site, and in order to do that, joining Tanis and myself this week, we got Diana and Sirion back. Welcome, both of you.
Hello, good to be back.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Everlight, hey? I always thought when we got the first archaeology glimpse back last year that Everlight was the most amazing, and we'll see if it is from the lore perspective. I know it's still mine that's most visually appealing to me, but we're of course getting ahead of ourselves here. If you want full show notes, you can find those at update.rsbnb.com. You can also, of course, check us out in game at Friends Chat Bits Bytes. I am Shane12088. Tanis is Tanis79. Sirion is just Sirion, and Diana is Dianima. I believe that's what your RS name is. I never get what the underscores is, but if you want to see either Diana or Sirion, just, you know, guest in Bits Bytes or guest in Clan Quest, either of those works. But aside from Everlight, we got a ninja strike this week and clarification on last week's treasure hunter exploit that we talked about. A rather amazing turn of events with that, but we'll get to all of that in due time, of course. So let's just dive right into Everlight, I think, because, you know, this is one of the more, well, I was going to say this is one of the more interesting dig sites to me, but they're all interesting to me when it's put on that front. But Everlight is definitely up there, and I don't know how you guys feel. Maybe we'll come up with an answer to that by the end of the show where that sits. But the reason Everlight's interesting to me is because I don't remember what my rec quest it was in back in the day, but there is always the talk of the Icene and what exactly the Icene were. And, you know, we never really got to dive that deep into what exactly their culture was and what role they had in the formation of what eventually became the Eastern Lands that was, you know, ravaged. And I feel that the Everlight dig site provides a nice glimpse into some of that history. And, you know, it goes back to one of the earliest RuneScape quest lines, and that's really special to me. So,
yes, good. It was the final, two quests in the Mareki line featured a lot of Icene lore. One of the main characters in the Mareki line is Saphalan,
yep,
who is half Icene, half human, and his mother was the queen of the Icene. So that's where it all ties in. And you're right, this has a big expansion on what we previously knew about Icene lore. I think it's my favorite site out of all of them. I finished it today, and I've got a fair way through all the other ones as well. But from a visual perspective and from how it's structured and how the story comes together, I think this is my favorite site of the five.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad it's the Icene you're obsessed with. I thought you were just gonna, you know, admit that you're secretly a big Ceridoan fan, in which case I would have had
no
friendship.
I don't like Ceridoan. Kind of.
All right,
yeah.
Laying down the gauntlet early on. I see. So let's just start off with a bit of a backgrounder around this one. I believe this one unlocks at level 42. And it's located on the very southeast tip of the continent, even further southeast than Mauritania, further southeast than the Araxor Cave. And we're greeted with this landmass change from, you know, what is all previously dead and barren swamp to something that is one of the most beautiful vistas in all of RuneScape. And you have this entire beacon coming out of the sea, and that's showcased in the cutscene when you first get there, which that beacon is, of course, the Everlight. And I think this is where we can begin.
Yeah, so the first thing about this site that's quite surprising is the site manager. And it is Vanescula Draken, of all people, and she's a vampire. Again, one of the main characters from the Mareki line kind of becomes the antagonist towards the end.
Yeah.
After you kill her older brother, Lord Draken, in, I think, the penultimate quest. And then you fight her in the final quest, and you defeat her, and you end up with this weird kind of truce arrangement between the humans, between the vampires, and between Queen Arifate, who's the Queen of the Iceene. And that's kind of, if you finished all those quests and got caught up in all the 6th Age and 5th Age lore, that's the position you find yourself in here when you meet her at the dig site. I was a bit surprised to see her here.
Yeah,
because
it's
the Drakan's family fault that Everlight is in the state it's in at the moment. It was Lord Draken who sacked the city and destroyed it, sank it below the waves. So what's she doing here?
Yeah.
I believe we covered this a bit in our initial lore rundown back in March now,
April.
Before the skill came out. We had a brief summary
March,
of it.
Right, we did do that. Right.
Yeah, which is quite a long time ago now. Oh, my God.
Time doesn't exist this year anymore.
Yeah, no, it's still March as far as I'm concerned.
Anyways.
Vanessa is sort of the most, almost the most suitable side lead for me. Like, I absolutely love that you get there and, like, all it's about is, like, turn off this bloody light, I can't sleep. Which is, to me, that's the most RuneScape-y of all the side leads. of all of them. Like
it's
that.
Kind of comedic, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah.
And like, I like Vanescula a lot. I think she's the kind of fantasy genre character we don't see enough of, which is the stone cold bitch.
Yeah.
Like, you don't get enough of that, really, in many fantasy games, so it's nice to see her.
Did you just call her your side chick, Sarion?
No!
Oh, okay.
No, he didn't.
But I do wonder though, like I think we talked about this with like Morvario as well, like how, and even as Anadra, is that his name?
Yeah.
That's the point. I never speak these names out loud, so when I have to actually like try to pronounce them.
Oh gosh, I'm exactly the same. I'm dreading the next episode we do, which is the Bandos one.
I've been practicing.
I can't say a single one of those names, so God knows how that's going to go.
But
I've been practicing.
I wonder how the interaction sort of changed to the player as you, because you know, at level 42 archaeology, you can be pretty low level as a character and not have done any of the Myrick quests that have to do with Vanescula. So, you know, how that interaction develops over time, I think I'm quite interested to see that. But I guess there's only one way to find out.
Yeah, and we don't really have a way of
I think the way Vanescula is portrayed in this, the conversations you have with her, is very in keeping with her previous characterization.
Hmm.
Which is nice. I mean, it does lead on to, I've made a little note later on for one of the first mysteries where I have something to say about how she reacts. But, I think she's kind of characterized the way she has been previously, which is as this, you know, ice cold, doesn't really care, wants the Everlight gone because it's keeping her awake. It's too light, it's too bright, and obviously vampires don't like that. And that's her motivation for being here.
Right.
But in a secondary way, why? So my main question was, why doesn't Arifate, the queen, why isn't she here? This is her city. Because we know she's alive. We rescued her at the end of the vampire series. And she had a bit of pre-skill dialogue back in, I think, 25th of March is the date I've got here. So before the skill was released, she was here with Vanescula. And they were having a conversation. And she was basically saying how this place has too many painful memories for her. She can't bring herself to return yet. So maybe she will in future, but for now, the reasoning is it's just too painful for her. So that's the background we get for what happened here.
Well, I guess that's better in a way than having, you know, something preventing her from coming back, and you know it's by her choice with that regard. And you know, I think you can kind of see some of the foreshadowing in the reasons for that in the text of the mysteries, which we'll all ultimately get through, because I know there is a big emphasis on the Faraday in one of them. So
yeah.
So like, why is it too painful for her to come back? Like, I assume the sacking of that city is not a recent affair, right?
It's not recent, but Erfite has spent the last several thousand years as Drakkan's prisoner on the vampire homeworld. And the last time she was on Gelinor, she witnessed the sack of Hallowvale and the destruction of Everlight. Gotcha. And presumably the death of her husband and the loss of her son.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly what happened.
Which is put into in more detail. This is a really tragic site.
Yep.
Like, and it's something I kind of want to mention at the end, but this is my favorite site, and this is also, I think, the saddest of the five sites.
You can detect that from the music.
The music, oh, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? So beautiful. Like, all the archaeology music's brilliant, but the Everlight one is just... Yeah, it's so tragic and so sad. Very much, yeah, in keeping with the whole look of the place as well. Like, whenever you head onto the main island, you've got this weird blue light. And it's bright, it's beautiful, but there's something not quite right. It's too bright, it's too... Especially if you can kind of see it when you look at the shadows on the ground. They're kind of in the wrong direction, and they're too sharp, and they're too bright. Like, there's something quite off.
Interesting.
Here.
Interesting. I never noticed that about the shadows.
It's not just a graphics glitch?
It could just be a graphics glitch, but I think if it isn't, it also fits the theme.
Let's go with that. I like that explanation.
Let's go with that, yeah.
All right.
Let's go with that.
Is there any other preliminary information we need to hop on before we start talking about the layout of this site?
That was all I had next. I think what I was going to do for this episode is kind of go through it the same way as I did for Stormguard,
sure.
Which is go site by site,
okay.
Not site by site, kind of area by area in order of level, covering the research and the mysteries as we go through.
And on that, you know what actually makes sense to me now after going through all of Warforge and after all of Infernal Source, and what I like about this one and why I think I felt that from the very beginning Everlight was one of my favorites, it's because... With very few exceptions, you can access that entire dig site as soon as you walk onto it. You don't need to unlock, some ancient cavern that you need to walk through or something like that, the way you do in Warforge. It's all just right there.
Very expansive, isn't it?
And, you know, just feel and explore.
Yeah, it's a site that suits the, what's it called, the depth of field effect.
Yeah.
And yeah. Those kind of long distance visual effects you can play with it really suits that kind of area.
And anybody watching on the video version will see that in demo right now.
It's so interesting that you two say that, because these are the exact things that make me sort of dislike the site. I find, to me, it feels very sort of barren and empty empty. Like it
that's
doesn't
the point,
really have
though.
An atmosphere. Maybe, but to me, it doesn't really work. Like honestly, like, I find like the crampedness of Warforge, for example, works really well for me. Like that is an atmospheric site for me. Like I like that one much better than Everlight, which is just like random things splattered around a large landmass.
Okay,
so
I think that's probably an aesthetic choice, or like a personal like a preference with aesthetics, because I think Everlight is hugely atmospheric because it's so open and so empty, and you're picking through the ruins of a city, and there's nothing from that time there alive.
But it doesn't feel like a city, right? Like it feels like there are a few ruins that are part of a city. Like to me, it's a bit immersion breaking that there's only so little of. Like it feels very gameplay focused in a way, right? Like wherever you see like a pillar sticking out of the ground, there's some gameplay mechanic nearby. So it's a bit immersion breaking for me.
See, like, I'm completely the opposite, but
no, that's why I find it so interesting that apparently that people interpret that so differently.
Well, let's dive into the let's dig into the first area that you can start digging around.
So the first area you get to are a really grim opener. You start with mass graves.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't get much darker than that. And what this is the aftermath of the vampire destruction of the city, the vampire sacking of Halivale. Yes, you find unmarked graves and kind of piles of skeletons and mounds of earth. And there's two mysteries and one bit of research you find here. Then the research is basically just saying the central island is covered in burial mounds. These mass graves are for those who fell during the sacking of Everlight. So that's just telling you exactly what's going on. The first mystery, and is kind of the introduction to... This was the introduction to the skill itself at the Runefest demo.
Okay,
I remember.
Yes,
four
yes.
This,
all right.
This was how the introduction to the mechanics.
I played this exact site. Like, when you... Yeah, you would do the tutorial, and then they would level you up to level 42 and basically put you where you are. Yeah,
this was the first introduction to the site, to the overall skill we had.
Yes.
And it's called Fallen Angels. And yeah, you uncover what's kind of very flippantly referred to as a frying pan, in inverted commas. Show it to Vernescula. I might call her Drakan of the three of this just because it's an easier word to say, but I do mean Vernescula Drakan, then, not her brother. And she tells you how to restore it and tells you to bury it in the Icene graveyard. And the point I want to raise here, this was my only real criticism of how the site was written and handled. And I'm going to use a buzzword that Sirion used a few weeks ago, ludonarrative dissonance. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. It's kind of to do with how Vernescula is characterized, and it's kind of to do with how the site is put together in terms of atmosphere. So yeah, as I mentioned, this whole place feels very sad and very tragic, and a lot of people died here. And what you're doing is you're reburying unmarked grave goods. To me, that feels like it should be something respectful. And it should be kind of recognizing the horror of what happened here. Instead, we have Vernescula's kind of flippant, oh, it's a frying pan. Oh, it doesn't matter. Kind of almost, I don't know whether she's trying to be funny or whether they're trying to be, the writers are trying to be comedic here. But it's in keeping with Vernescula's characterization. Like, she would say something like that. She would show that disrespect. But you as a player don't get a chance to challenge her.
Right. And
I personally would have really appreciated the chance to say, show some goddamn respect.
Yes.
Your brother did this.
Because your character would know what was going on, just based on what we kind of inferred from the Myrek quest.
Yeah, and Vernescula tells you.
Yeah.
She tells you that her brother did this.
It's super interesting. Like, I didn't have it in this particular instance, but I recognized that feeling like immediately, because that's how I felt in in the past for some other things in the game. So I can totally see where you're coming from. Like, sometimes you feel that the game is not giving you the freedom to...
Yeah, it's the game not giving you the freedom you feel like you should have as a player avatar, and also the tone of the game's design not matching up with the story. That's where the dissonance comes in.
Yeah.
But I just really would have appreciated one line or one bit of dialogue where I could say to Vernescula that she shouldn't be being so flippant about this. But that's kind of my only bit of criticism here.
And when you think about it, that's an okay piece of criticism to have. And if that's all we got for this one dig site so far, we're doing pretty good.
Well, it is in line with, like, I mean, she's a vampire, right?
Like, yeah, it's very much in character for her.
I mean, but it was vampires that destroyed the place. They're not there because they're, like, trying to, like, save it for posterity. They're there because the light's too bright. So...
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean by it. It fits her, but it doesn't fit me in my playstyle. And it would have been nice to see that brought in, I think. But that's more kind of a personal thing, and it's not really an overarching criticism.
Yeah, it doesn't diminish the gameplay and whatnot.
No.
Yeah.
But I did feel a bit of a jar there.
And if I recall, this mystery was the one that... underscored... was this the one they were talking about, their return... Or their arrival on Gelinor, or is that the next one? No, that was the next one.
Yeah, the second mystery you uncover here is more about Erifite, and it's okay. Kind of her, it's Queen of the Iceene. You uncover her journal entries, and it tells the story of how the Iceene came to Gelinor and how the Everlight was created. And I think we've covered this before in a previous one, but just a quick recap that the Iceene's homeworld, New Domina, has a year-long day-night cycle, and traditionally they all stay in the light all the time because yeah. The night's really dark and dangerous and cold, and they die there. So when they came to Gelinor, when Saradomin brought them to Gelinor as part of the core of his fighting force, and it got dark at night, that's obviously not very nice for them.
That was the whole reason to build the beacon.
That was the reason to build the beacon, yeah. So Saradomin built this beacon to provide them with eternal light.
And the reason I got confused on this is, there was a series of events that didn't lead to this happening, but I was going to summarize all of the mysteries into, one paragraph. And I did the Queen of the Iceene one, and for some reason I did that one first, so that's why I thought that was the first entry here. But nonetheless... anything else on Fallen Angels, or should we move on to Queen of the Iceene?
I just want to say, like, the Hallowtide lore and the whole concept of Hallowtide being such a different planet, I really, really like that about...
Yeah.
It's probably my favorite part of the lore, like, even though we don't learn that much about it, nice that they have gone to the effort of designing... not just a generic fantasy planet where they come from, where, there's only slightly weird plants and animals. No, there's like, because that's what happens like a lot of the time, right? But like they came up with a concept that is not necessarily original and new, but very different and plausible. So, I really enjoyed that part and how that fed into why the site exists and what it is. So yeah.
It's a nice example of really solid world building that informs, a nice yes. bit of culture in this alien race.
Because you give me little hints towards this origin in the culture everywhere.
Yeah.
And that makes it feel less artificial.
So much more real.
It's also kind of something interesting about Saradominism, where light is kind of the key part. And that's because, back in the day, Saradomin was good, and then obviously this is a Western fantasy story. If you're going to base that on, people, a traditionally Christian society, light is good, dark is evil. Here's a different reasoning for it, and a more original reasoning for it.
Yeah, and when you put it that way, we even have the satanic archaeology dig site in terms of infernal source.
Yeah, but again, there were slightly more original twists on it.
Yeah, exactly.
The whole theme, it was nice to see.
That's a very good way of providing commentary on the threads that everybody is familiar with in the world, I find.
I actually think it is meant... like, I think Saradomin and Zamorak were created very much with this sort of Western culture yep. bias that we have, yep. right? And in a way, this idea of Saradomin and Hallowtide is probably, sort of... retconned to sort of explain that, but I think it does it really well. It feels really natural, and I think it moves it away from the bias and starts giving it its own form and shape, which right. is why yeah.
And we first saw that in World Event 1, because before that everybody just, assumed the generic good versus evil of Saradomin versus Zamorak, and we've learned since then that it's a lot more nuanced, and that's
I think good. Even World Event 1 itself, it was still pretty
they tried. They were trying to branch out, I think, with that one, but everyone was still pretty stuck.
Yeah. I think it's Dishonor amongst Thieves.
Dishonor Among Thieves really solidified it. But
yes.
Let's resume with Queen of the Iceene, because in addition to talking about how they came to Gelinor from New Domina, that alien world, which, one more comment on that, wouldn't it be neat if we could somehow in the future go there and visit?
We have the World Gate.
I'd love
to. Well, I think we would see that, like, the way that I took all of that is it kind of shows you kind of how the tradition, where it comes from, as in it was a very materialistic need to be in that light. You know what I mean? Like, that's where they...
It was a matter of life and death.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you can see where this comes from, right? Like, if it's... That's very... Like, what's more material than life and death?
Yeah, going on the Great Pilgrimage.
If they went into the dark, they would literally freeze to death.
There you go.
Like,
oh, I'd love to go to that planet and then have, like, the light and day as actual gameplay mechanic where, like, different strips of the world map are available at different days
of the
week.
You dare go into the dark and face what's in there.
Yeah. Oh, that's
that would be fun. That would be really fun.
Wow. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm going to go on a tangent and design this on the spot.
In addition to that, we learned that, you know, there was something Queen Aparite was actually supposed to have a different husband than she wound up with.
Yeah, so this is kind of more of a glimpse into Iceni culture and kind of pre-Saradominist Iceni culture. Queen Aparite was meant to marry the leader of the military, Archon Babel. But whenever she came to Gilenor and they started bringing in human allies, she fell in love with a human man, Ascyrtes, who I think is meant to be a soldier or a warrior of some kind.
Yeah, and that whole initial marriage was tradition and convenience. And if you read the actual text of the Queen of the Iceni mystery, there's a... I'm trying to think of the word to describe it, but she is very resolute in that she is not going to do this. She knows that she should, but her feelings are telling her otherwise. But the fact we're on a different world right now, we can make some exceptions. And even Saradomin gave the blessing for her not to do that.
Yeah, I think from Saradomin's perspective, it was symbolic of the alliance between humans and Iceni that were kind of the core of his military forces.
Yeah, that's exactly
why. That was the advantage for him. Babel was not happy with this, and he actually gets his own law book later on, where he discusses why he's not happy about this.
Isn't it beautiful how these small personal stories are used as a commentary on this fictional culture? Like, to me,
something I really enjoy about this skill is that there's a lot of personal stories.
Exactly, but like...
And it's not just great big sociological stories. There's a lot of really personal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it dives in. It goes in really fine and really deep. And it gives you a kind of a wider picture while it does that. It's very clever.
Like, we learn about these things from a very biased perspective. And then, you know, we might be led to believe things in one way at, like, the earlier levels of a site. And then the more we learn, the more those earlier stories are also put back into context. And all of a sudden, you know, like there might be a big spin and a big twist in sort of how things go. And I think they balance that really, really nicely.
Yeah.
In all these little personal stories.
The writers for this.
It was the
really
same in the Infernal Source about when we find out about what demons are really like.
Yeah, exactly.
It was told through small personal stories that flipped what we thought we know about demons on its head. It's exactly the same thing happening here.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Anyways, let's continue with Queen of the Iceni because, you know, as with every story in the archaeology lore, there is tragedy involved. Because, you know, we got to frame this in terms of the war that they were brought to fight because, you know, this wasn't just a vacation or a colonization trip, right? It was actually out of necessity that they come fight for Saradomin against the Majorat Zaros and whatnot. And with that, there's, of course, sacrifice. Her new husband was captured.
Yeah, so when Drakkhan took Everlight and took the city, he captured Ascyrtes. And under threat, I assume threat of death, Aerithae surrendered to him. And kind of ordered everyone else to get clear, to evacuate if they could. She would surrender to save her husband. Her son's already been smuggled out to safety somewhere, and then we meet him much later on whenever he's grown up and he's Saphalan. I think it's safe to assume that Ascyrtes was killed at this point.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure. And Aerithae was taken back to the vampire homeworld and remained there.
Right. And you know what I remember when we first learned about this relationship between Aferite and Saphalan and who the dad was in the vampire quest, that was certainly a twist, and I'm glad to see that they have expanded on that. And, you know, I always wonder in these kind of situations, was this lore written back when they were developing the Myrex series, or was this lore written for archaeology?
Probably a mix of both. Like, whenever you're designing a quest, whenever you're designing a story, you're going to feature much less in the actual final product than the world building and the character building that went into it. So there'll be lots of notebooks and sticky notes and things with all this lore on the outside that you can then pick up and include in later features. What are you laughing at?
I recognize myself as I look at my desk with random post-it about my world building notes just lying around.
Yeah, my experience in making games.
I feel attacked.
What you put in the final product is a much narrower slice of what was actually created.
I just, as we talk through these things, like each of these mysteries tells a story in themselves that would not stand amiss as having an entire quest about Runescape. So thinking about this skill and how, you know, I don't know how many mysteries there are in total, like 30, 40?
Quite a lot,
like,
yeah.
Like the amount of effort it must have taken to develop all this lore compared to, you know, just a quest.
We asked for a lore skill, we got it.
Like, it's a monumental effort. Like, I guess it only just dawns on me, like, how expensive all of this is. Like, how detailed all these stories are.
And think about how concisely the stories are told.
Yeah, because each of these mysteries, in terms of the pages,
is really hard, right? Like, there's this famous saying, which is like, if I'd had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. As in to say, you know, it's harder to write something concisely and shorter than to just, you know, ramble on. So, yeah.
Boy, do we know that with the podcast.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Much so, especially in episodes like this.
But also with Queen of the Icene, you know, we just go from something that was talking about the arrival to the marriage and then to this dark tragedy of first the capture, but then also the telling of the story about how the city of Everlight was just sunk and blown to bits, for lack of a better term.
So, yeah, she says they wanted to keep Draken away from the Everlight because it's a divine source of power. And to do that, they sabotage the mechanism to access it. And that's kind of your first hint at what you have to do at the end of the skill to try and get back to it. More on that later. Obviously, Draken then, this isn't confirmed in the logbook, but I think it's safe to assume, you know, enraged at not being able to access it, just razed the city and sank the Everlight to the bottom of the ocean. You know, decimated it.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And I'm probably safe to assume that there were not many survivors at all.
No. And that's
Draken.
And that's Queen of the Icene. You know, we go from this high of arriving on a new world to, you know, the absolute darkest and biggest tragedy that you can have. All in one mystery. And you get this at level 42, folks.
This is your hook.
Yeah,
for the whole site, this is the hook. But then you move up a few levels and you move up to the northern side where you find an amphitheater. And there's not a lot to do here. There's one bit of research called Ode to a Midsummer Morning, which says whatever epics were performed at Everlight's amphitheater have been lost to time. Unfortunately, the team could not find any more detailed information about this area. So what you've got here is your typical Greek theater. And
isn't this also where there's the first statue you can fix and repair?
Yeah, there's four statues through the sites that you can restore, and you get artifacts whenever you pay your respects to them. And the first one here is Mesomedes. Is that how you say it? Mesomedes?
I think so. We'll just go with that. And when you, of course, repair the statue and you pay your respects to it, it recharges your prayer as well.
Which is nice.
Which none of the other sites have.
Well, that's nice for your imp soul.
Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that we didn't get to spend more time at the amphitheater, because the artifacts you excavate here also gave the materials that you precisely needed for them. I think this is in the 50-ish range, if I remember correctly. And there's also a material cart nice and close to it as well. So this
was a nice little part for the fifth, I think the 40 to 60-ish grind. Yeah, this is a nice place for it.
I spent a lot of time here in that range. And very, same. Very nice.
I still have a lot of a lot of those statues unfinished, like lying around.
So this area isn't really, there's not a lot of lore here, but again, it's more cultural backdrop and more of a cultural background of what Iceene got up to in their spare time.
Yeah.
You know, music and plays and coming together as a group to experience entertainment. Again, in a very classical Greek style. So it's more kind of colouring in the background rather than the actual details, but again, very nice to have.
Yeah, and it's all gone now.
And all gone, all completely destroyed.
And, you know, that actually pivots nicely into the next site that you'll go excavate, and that's Dominion Games because – and, you know, this was jarring for me, and I was trying to figure out how to do this when I had to take the computer in for repair because this was where I was when I was about to do the summary video, which, you know, I still want to get to. But we go from this, you know, providing the backstory of what happened with the arrival and ultimately the death of her husband to now just, you know, getting a bit of backdrop of what the Iceene culture was like to the point where, you know, even here on this alien world, they continue their cultural trends of hosting what are effectively amount to Olympic Games.
Yeah, this is the parallel to the Greeks Olympic Games as the Dominion Games. Which were conducted on Eudomena, and then when they came to Gilenor, Erephyte continued them to kind of help ground their culture here. And there's three areas to it. There's a podium, there's a kind of weapons rack area up on an Acropolis, and there's an actual stadium as well. Which
you also find another statue in this area.
Yes, there's another statue in this
the
area.
The Patterson statue. So, and
but yeah, so this is basically the Olympics, but for Iceene.
And, you know, I think with that, there's always the question of, is it going to be what happened, or are we going to do the world building bit of the culture behind the scenes? And, you know, when I started going through this mystery, I thought, okay, this is interesting. Is it really going to amount to much? I didn't think it was, but it did in the end. And that's good. Filled out the gap in the knowledge and just provided, I guess, the filling of what we didn't know about the Iceene, let's say.
Yeah. The mystery you find here is Fall and Rise, which is another journal-based one. Again, another really personal story, featuring one participant in the Dominion Games, Podozin.
And that's the statue we recover.
Yep, another statue story. There.
Yeah.
And it's basically summarizing how she was an athlete. She had a freak accident during a race against her brother and lost her wings, basically. And so there's the fall. And then it's basically her coming to terms with that and then competing in other events. So again, not really relevant to the wider lore, and the wider story, but a kind of personal bit of background and kind of, I don't know whether I'm extrapolating too much from this, but slightly illustrating how Iceene view themselves how Iceene view other races.
That's exactly the way I'd put it. And it also shows what the Iceene were like when they didn't have to, you know, worry about being part of this army, Ceridoan's army.
Yeah, you did have people who were athletes and kind of taking part in very, peacetime type prospects. You know, she was a marathon runner or a marathon flyer, I think was the equivalent. But the nice bit here, the bit I really liked, this bit that her brother is still alive and in game, is Padamenes, who is one of Ceridoan's generals. He was in the first world events, and you can now find him in Falador Castle, and he's just hanging around there.
Yeah, and you actually have to take an artifact to him, I believe it is, to complete this mystery, right?
Yeah, so when you restore her statue, you find a gold Dominion medal And you find bronze and silver ones in one of the excavation sites, but the only gold one you find is in her statue. You can then talk to her brother, and he says, please give that to me. I miss my sister. You know, she's dead and I miss her a lot. So just as a memento, can I have her medal? And if you give it to him, he tells you how to take the power of the Everlight. You have to use a Canthros cup, which is another relic, another artifact, and use it on the light. And that's how you can take some of the power for yourself. And that's a clue for a later mystery.
Which is the clue for the conclusion of this dig site. And, you know, I just want to illustrate for many people out there that there is going to be a huge gap from the time you complete Fall and Rise to the time in which you're able to actually go and capture the Everlight.
Yeah, what's the level difference? I forget. Fall and Rise is...
Fall and Rise is... I don't know offhand.
Fall and Rise is level 61.
Oh my.
And then the Everlight, which is the final mystery, is level 105. So that's a considerable gap.
But so that's maybe not a to say that question. There's stuff that you can't do in that time period. Yeah?
Maybe a stupid question. How old do I see and get?
This is a difficult question. I think they're very, very long time. Is the safest answer. Padomenes is still alive, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm asking.
He's portrayed as... It's kind of implied that he's portrayed as a young man at the time this journal was written.
And we're looking back to just before the Third Age, right?
Yes. I think these events happening kind of during the Third Age, after the God Wars started. It's not entirely clear, but I'm assuming they're taking place in the early Third Age.
Yeah.
Which is several thousand years ago.
And aren't the vampires also long-lived like that, too?
Yeah, vampires are similarly aged. I mean, Vanescina was around during that time, and the Drakhans were around during that time. So I don't think they're strictly immortal, but they're very, very long-lived.
Okay.
But I don't know for sure. Zoyan is the same. She was alive during the God Wars and she's still alive today, although she was in the God Wars dungeon all that time, so I don't know whether that's had an impact.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of frozen thing going on with that, if I remember the
Something
lore when
weird
that
went
came
on
out.
There.
Yeah. Anything else on Dominion Games or Fallen Rise?
Nothing else from me. I just think this is another really nice bit of culture.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
A nice bit of adding in the background.
Yeah. And, you know, the next one is like that as well, in particular, in terms of the cultural impact that they have. And that's the Dower of Babel. Or is that how you say that? Dower? Doer?
Dower of Babel, yeah. So that's a reference to the Tower of Babel, obviously, which is a biblical myth. Yeah. And then Dower is obviously, he's in a grump, he's at a strop. So this is down in the households area. So kind of the normal civilian houses, there are artisans and fishermen here. Looking at the kind of, there's a crafter's studio and a fishing hut, looking at the artifacts, excavation sites. So very normal people live here, not soldiers.
So they're called oikos, right?
Yeah.
I think that's how you say it, oikoi, and then oikos.
That's actually a Greek term that... They refer to like these apartment buildings that cities had.
Did we ever figure out why there's the actual, you know, Greek influence on this? Because obviously they're not Greek.
I think it's the same reason. If there is any reasoning, it would be the same reason as why is the Zarosian Empire based on ancient Roman Empire.
All right. Fair enough.
I mean, it is... Possibly it was chosen because it's similar but a foil, in a sense. And obviously the Greeks and Romans are kind of always portrayed as these similar but contrasting ancient empires. So that might be why the two were picked.
It's also the Roman Empire sort of overthrew the Greek one. So there might be something going on there as well.
Maybe, yeah. But you'd have to ask Mod Jack, why he actually decided on ancient Greece as the informing culture for this particular society.
I mean, I think it makes sense when you look back at it, I was just wondering why, you know, we got actual Greek words in here. I'm not complaining about it. I was just wondering.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of actual Latin in the Roman ones.
Yeah. But Tower of Babel, this is where we actually get to hear Archon Babel's side of what happened here. And we go back to another, it doesn't start dark, but it gets dark, I feel, on this one.
So this is the Journal of Archon Babel, who was the head of the Icene military forces. And he was the one who was meant to marry Aphrodite. Obviously, that didn't happen.
And we learned that he's such a coward.
You think?
I think so.
Well, I'll have to get the law book up again.
I don't know. Do your summary, and I'll tell you where I feel that the coward aspect comes in.
So, yeah, the first kind of part of it discusses what he thinks of other forces that are fighting for Sarodomen at the moment. You know, he has a lot of respect for the centaurs. He has a lot of respect for the lion kind. He doesn't really have much respect for humans because they're short. They're not very graceful. They can't fly. They are cumbersome and banal, is how he describes humanity, lacking the centaur's accuracy, the unicorn's speed, or the lion's ferocity. But the only thing in their favor is their abundance. So, that's basically all he sees humans as good for. There's a lot of them. And this is actually an attitude that comes up a few times when looking at how the near immortal races view humanity. Kind of, you see it in the Zarosian Empire, you see it in the Zamorakian forces. Humans, there's a lot of them, and that's basically the only thing going for them.
You can't even fault them.
They're not wrong. I mean, compared to everything else we've got running around the game, I mean, humans, we're adaptable, and there's lots of us, and that's it. Which is, you know, a bit funny. But yeah, if nothing else, they will provide us with a wall of flesh to guard us from our enemies. Thanks, Babel.
And the reason I say cowardly is that, you know, he was in charge of effectively protecting the city. And there's a point in one of the journals, I forget which one exactly of his, where rather than protecting the city, he goes off in the other direction and retreats past it, effectively letting the city become overrun.
It's right at the end where he's discussing what actually happens during the vampire siege.
There you go.
So,
and
he talks a bit about Aphrodite as well and how outraged he is that she's choosing to marry a human
and
flying in the face of tradition.
And I thought, you know, with that, maybe it's because of her decision to marry Aphrodite instead that he took the actions he did rather than, you know, putting up a stronger defense and holding at Everlight, because I think the exact line in that book was that he was ordered to hold at Everlight, but he didn't.
Yeah, I think that's from Aphrodite's journal. She said that she wanted him to hold at Everlight, but he did something different. And then what he did, or how he describes it in the final page, is that I've instructed my generals to slowly start maneuvering their soldiers over water around the Vire siege, so they will be well placed to pincer the Vires when the fight comes.
Okay, so he thought he was handling it a different way and, you know, being more strategic. But as we saw from Aphrodite's perspective, it looked as though that he didn't follow the order that he was given. And, you know, that's why I thought, oh, maybe, you know, we might have had a different outcome. And maybe it was in relation because she didn't marry him. But that's just my...
He was certainly bitter about it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go as far to say that personal grudge made him disobey and, you know, cost the city. I'm not sure whether that's a fair conclusion to make. But yeah, he was certainly bitter about tradition not being followed and about his right to her not being acknowledged.
All right. Then in this one, I think we also had, as we mentioned, the description of Draken's attack on Everlight, and, you know, we obviously know the fate of what happened with Everlight, and instead he opted to attack Centistan instead, And at this point, did anybody else also feel that, you know, these early...
Hang on, who was attacking Saint Istin? Saradomin was attacking Saint Istin at this point.
Sorry, who?
Saradomin.
Oh, the Saradomin forces, Saint-Istin. Yes.
Because that's where Zamorak was based. Zamorak had taken the city and was using that as his seat of power. So the reason Saradomin couldn't come to the aid of Everlight during this attack is that he was focused on fending off Zamorak's counterattacks with demons. And I think in the lore book, they describe green-skinned mercenaries, which will be goblins and Bandosian forces.
Yep.
Because both Zamorak and Saradomin bought mercenaries off Bandos during the God Wars. So that's where they come from. They came from the Warforge.
Yeah,
I was about to say, don't we learn that like in one of the different lore
books? We learn that in Warforge or something.
Yeah, but yeah, there's a nice little link to one of the other sites here is that that was kind of why Saradomin had to leave Everlight to be attacked and to be sank.
All right. Anything else on the Oikoi or the Babel mystery?
That was all I had here. Yeah. It's only really the next couple of sites that the story gets going again. Yeah. Most of this is cultural backing.
Yeah, and that's good.
It's lovely. It's really, really nice.
But these next ones, you know, really kick it into that high notch and once again just start tying everything together masterfully.
Yeah. So the next site you move to is the Acropolis. Again, traditional Greek setting, a place where people would come together for verbal... not entertainment, but more kind of debates and idea sharing.
That's the kind of... I mean, the Acropolis was mostly a religious place in Athens, right?
Yeah, in Athens, the Acropolis was a temple.
Right.
I suppose what would be the equivalent... In Rome, it would be a forum. I don't know what the equivalent was in ancient Greece, off the top of my head.
Was it an agora?
That would be it. Kind of a place where people came together to talk and to have meetings and to do debates and that kind of stuff.
Agora.
You know, philosophers and people would come here to do academic things as well.
My knowledge from middle school about ancient Greek culture is finally paid off.
So yeah, it's not an Acropolis in the literal sense of the word, but it's that kind of style. And you can see from its placement in game, it's up on a hill, and it's got that architecture as well.
And this is also the dig site where we get the rod of Asclepius, which is this is another Greek influence. If you look at the description of this one, it says Asclepius seems to be a figure from early Icene culture, and there's a connection with him being a renowned healer or surgeon. And it's a snake or worm twisted around a spindle that is also connected with medicine.
So is that Apollo?
No, Asclepius is actually a well-known... he was a god, but it's not the same as Apollo. He was the god of medicine.
Okay, so he was an actual mythological
figure. And then the snake, like in many logos of like healing, like organizations, the snake is still, you know, part of the logo. Like I know in the Netherlands, for example, I think like the main logo of pharmacies contains like that snake, like that's symbolism has sort of persisted all that time.
So they're taking it very literally then.
Yeah.
From real life mythology and transposed.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
And That of course leads into the mystery in this area, the Epic of Hebe. Is that how you say that?
It's either the Epic of Hebe or the Epic of Hebe, and I don't know enough Greek to confirm. I say Hebe. I could be wrong. Correct me if I am.
All right.
Anyone who's looking for
the English people would call it Hebe. Yeah.
It could be Hebe.
No, trailing E's would definitely be pronounced.
Okay, I'll say Hebe then. What I found really interesting about this is that it is a fictional story in its own right. And you can find out a lot about a culture by the stories they tell each other and the stories they tell themselves. What they, like, especially if it's an epic. So epic stories are kind of, they're quite moralistic. They're things to aspire to. You've got these heroes coming in and doing epic deeds. And it's like, oh, this is a, you know, like a superhero film these days. It's what kind of people are revered as being doing impressive things. So you can discover a lot about what the people are like and what they think is important through their stories and their myths. And I can't actually remember where else in game we have an in-game myth being told. Not actual lore, not actual history, but a myth. So that's a nice thing to have.
Nothing's coming to mind, but continue.
Yeah, I can't remember anything off the top of my head.
So interestingly, Hebe is actually a Greek goddess. Goddess of youth or the prime of life. And the official Greek pronunciation would be Hebe.
Oh, wow, so okay.
In English, it's generally pronounced as Hebe.
Okay. Yeah, in-game, she's characterized as this very spirited, very independent young Iceene who gets... I think back on Eudomina, she got involved in some trouble. She killed someone who was hurting people and got exiled to the Twilight Knights. This is another bit of nice Iceene background. This elite force of soldiers who were patrolling the barrier between day and night, doing whatever needed to be done on that boundary. And then when she came to Gilenor, she became so well known that she was granted a very special rank. And Sirin, you're going to have to help me out here because I don't know. Heteriori? Is that how you say it?
Let me look at the pronunciation. Hetairoi.
Hetairoi. Yeah. Kind of a leader of her own house. And that's a very high rank and a very special thing. And I think Saradomin himself gave her that. And what she started to do, it gave her independence to do what she wanted. So she defended the borders of Hallowvale and got into all these adventures where she, you know, fought and tamed a wild lion. She defeated a hydra. And all these things are very in keeping with what we might hear from Greek heroes. You know, you got Hercules and Jason and all doing these amazing feats and killing dragons and doing all that. Even as far as people aren't even sure if she's dead. She wandered off and, you know, maybe she's still alive. Maybe she's somewhere in the jungle with her lion, defending everyone with her cup of everlight light.
It's really interesting about the cup because in Greek mythology, Hebe was actually the cupbearer of the gods.
See, that's a nice link. I like that. But yeah, for you, like I said earlier, you can tell a lot about a culture by the stories they tell. So what does this story tell us? It kind of shows that despite the overarching Saradominus theme of order and social order and how you people thrive in structured societies, there's still room for respect for rebels and individual strength and bravery. And putting that to good use for society is something that's seen as an adventurous and good thing to do. And you can almost compare it to the story of Garlandia, who was the Iceene pacifist, who tried to convince this Iceene to stay on Eudomina, and Saradomin ripped her wings off. So, possibly a nice comparison there.
Now, with
military prowess versus pacifism within this kind of society.
Now, with this being the epic of Hebe, do we know if Hebe was a real character, or is this just something that was told as a story? Or could she perhaps exist?
I think it's the case where it's told as a story. It's told as a, here's what happened to Hebe back in the day. It could be the case that she was a real character, and maybe she did do some of these things, but possibly they've been blown up over time into this mythological character. Maybe she did actually do these things. It's entirely possible in RuneScape. It's a fantasy world. Entirely possible it's factual.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But it might not be. It might be an aspirational story as well.
All right.
But I found this a very interesting thing to do because, yeah, we haven't really had an actual story within the story here.
Yeah. Yeah. And just think of the impact this would be if this was actually found to be true.
Yeah, she's still in the jungle somewhere with her lion.
Yeah. this could all be one grand way of tying up the storyline someday. I'm just saying, I'm not saying that's actually going to happen. I'm just saying that's a possibility based on this.
I think it would be nice to leave her as fictional.
Yeah. And
it adds a lot to me.
And then it keeps that spark of wonder alive, let's just say.
So.
All right. Is it time to go underground yet?
It's time to go underground. The final stage of the entire dig site is figuring out what to do with the Everlight. How do you turn it off? How do you turn it down? How do you make sure Vanescula gets a good night's sleep?
Priorities.
Priorities, right? So what you do is you take a Dominion torch that you recover from the Dominion game site, and you plug it into a sconce that's kind of at the back of the Acropolis. There's a little gateway that's locked, and you have to put a torch in the sconce and light it, and that opens the door. And you go inside and go underground to a very surprising bit of environment to me.
I absolutely love the contrast here, the lighting, and just how it was so different than what was on top.
It's beautiful. It's so beautiful. And the music here is wonderful as well.
Yes.
There's a lot of lovely water effects and all these little corals and sea creatures that have become exposed. Now the Everlight has risen back out of the water. This bit was all completely underground, under the sea. So this bit is all, exposed now. And it's so lovely down here.
You know what's a real shame about this is that, I absolutely love the way this looks. But the real shame about this is that from what I can tell, there's only really two sets of artifacts down here that you'll uncover.
Yeah, there's only the stockpiled art and the... I don't actually know what the other one is yet because I haven't got to that level.
I think it's like 117 or something high like that. Yeah, it's that you'll very come high back down one. Under there. But I wish we could spend more time under there.
The remains of the soldiers, the Optimatoi remains down here as well. I like having the art. This is just a bit of a side note that we've had art in the Infernal Source, and there's art as well in Karad Et. But you get some here as well. And again, it's something I've said it again and again and again here with the musical instruments in Stormguard, the same, adding this background of culture that brings in a lot of weight for, if you think of the cost of adding this in, the cost of adding this into the game, the amount it brings to the story and the amount it brings to the game really outweighs it. And it's a lovely thing to have in.
Yeah.
If you look at the art in the journal, because it's like actual art.
Yeah, you can get a really nice up close look at them, which is lovely. So you got the Pride of Penosin, which again is the same character we saw earlier. You get a portrait of her. You get a painting called Hallowby the Everlight, which is important to later on in this particular location. And you get one called the Lord of Light, which shows Saradomin, obviously.
Of course, we also have to, Warforge has its art as well. Like we can't underestimate this Nozorok sculpture. I mean,
it does. Okay, to be fair, it does have art then in its own way.
Yeah.
Just not in a traditional sense.
Or in
an actual, visual painting sense. Not. Really.
And on the visuals with that, you proceed to the end of this cave and you see this broken mosaic that you have to put back together, which you do. You get mosaic pieces whenever you're excavating the 105 hotspot, but you dive underneath and you got this underwater area of the dig site that looks as stunning as anywhere else in the dig site.
Oh, it's gorgeous, isn't it?
It's really a shame that there's not much more to do under here except for gathering the cogs to repair the elevator.
Yeah, but it's another surprising addition to it, I suppose, in the same way that you get the wingsuit in Stormguard, but on a much smaller scale. It's got a really lovely twist and a lovely surprise.
I personally have to say that this is the most amazing graphical bit in archaeology, I feel. You guys could say otherwise, but this is definitely a favorite.
I think the actual end of this mystery is the most beautiful one.
Okay.
But you're right, this bit is also very pretty. They've done a lot with water effects recently, kind of, you know, with Elite Dungeon 3 and various other things.
Yeah, we've certainly come a long way from water just being a texture on top of something that was a little bit different than land with that. And, you know, under here you also uncover the Hallowed Bee mystery, which is effectively not a lore mystery. It's just getting the mosaic pieces and fixing the elevator with the cogs.
Yeah, so the final two mysteries are more like puzzles than lore-related mysteries. But yeah, once you've got all the mosaic pieces, you put the thing back together and it's the same as the Hallowed Be the Everlights painting that you've picked up. And that fixes, or half fixes, the lighthouse elevator. And you can go up.
Boom. And then this leads directly into the Everlight mystery. Forgive me if I'm getting ahead of myself here, because it just seems like a natural flow on this. And this is where also those shields that you've been gathering throughout your time at Everlight are actually going to come into use.
Mm-hmm. So you end up in this room kind of halfway up the tower with four really beautiful murals on the walls showing different styles of Icene Warrior. And they're all missing a shield, so you pick up the four shields that you've gathered kind of at the archaeology sites kind of throughout the skill as you've got here. You put them on the walls, you solve a little slider puzzle to make sure they go in the right place to kind of complete the murals.
That's one thing I quite like about Everlight, that it has more than all the other sites, is that Everlight is very climactic. Like, almost everything you do at Everlight is working towards this one moment of, you know, going up the lighthouse and meeting the light. Like,
I love that.
Like all the statues you do, and then finding that gold medal, getting the hint, you know, the Dominion torch you use, like all the artifacts you use on the way to get here. Like, it's really, you know, it's a culmination of all the discoveries you've done at this site to get to the end. Like, I think this site does that best of all of them. Like, this is just such a, like, the entire, it feels like very little of Everlight is irrelevant. Like, you get to the bit with, say, like the Infernal Source, right? Like, you're done there.
It's
at
also
level 68.
It's also a bit incorrect at as well. I don't know if you've got to that point yet.
No.
Karadet is a bit more sprawling, but you're right. The single core of the site is very concise, and that's good. That's really good. It doesn't go off on many tangents. It keeps you really focused on this one aim, which is do something about the Everlight. But I agree, it is all very much focused on this one thing, and everything just kind of link in. But yeah, once you've solved that puzzle, up you go again, and you get to the top of the tower.
And this is what I feel like, you know, somebody writing the last paragraph of a story, and then, you know, he reached into his inventory, pulled out the Cantharos cup, and took the Everlight.
Yeah. So you take a bit of the Everlight for yourself, and it becomes a relic that you can hand in at the monolith for a goodie that I can't remember.
Oh, we're so bad. We're so bad.
I think it's extra adrenaline.
Yeah, that's the one that boosts your adrenaline, I believe.
Gives you 10% more adrenaline.
Yeah.
But this particular location, I reached it today, you know, midday today when I was working on this in my lunch break. And it's amazing. Absolutely amazing, the view you have up here.
Yeah. And
so beautiful.
It really brings, you know, it really shows the capabilities of this new NXT client. Like, we take it for granted now, but, you know, the NXT client isn't that old yet.
Yeah.
So,
the effects,
you know,
of the light on the water and the scale, it really showcases how they've gone in for grandeur and scale and size in these series of updates. Like, usually, you know, people talk about scale theory in game, by technical necessity, most of the game is smaller than it would be and you would expect. You've just kind of got to do a bit of mental math in your head almost to make it make sense. Say, oh, it only takes 30 seconds to run from one city to another city. But here at last, you get a sense of realistic scale. And this very small area shows it off so beautifully.
Yeah, and I actually pulled off an amazing cinematic for this when I was gathering footage and setting up this episode. I went to the top of the Everlight in free camera and I just panned backwards, and you start off so small up there, but you just keep going, pulling the camera back, pulling it back, pulling it back. And you see how huge this thing really is. Then you pan down a bit and you're like, oh, there's the dig site where we were. You can see, you know, the Dominion Games podium. You can see the amphitheater and whatnot. You can see all of that from right up there.
It feels to scale to your character model, which is nice. And, you know, it feels so huge. But, yeah, this is probably one of my favorite spots in game now, from visual perspective.
Nice.
Wonderful. Really wonderful.
All right. What did we learn from that? I mean, we took some Everlight and, you know, we didn't actually turn it off because after you complete this mystery, it's still on. So Vanessa is still going to have her sleeping issues.
But we can access the Everlight now. And yeah, that's the real resolution of this, is that you can get to it.
Right, because when they started out, there was the magical forces preventing them from doing so.
Yeah, we basically fixed the elevator. That's what we did. We fixed the elevator.
And in doing so, we learned so much about the Icene culture. We learned so much about their arrival from New Domina. And, you know, I have a question on this as we wrap this. Would we have preferred to have this in a quest, you know, a quest that you spend an hour, hour and a half on? Or is this the better way of going about it throughout, just getting tidbits from a skill from level 42 to 105?
I don't think this story could have worked as a quest. I think the story only works because you get all these personal... I mean, I guess it could have worked as a quest, but, you know, I think, you know, you need that experience of all these personal stories, and you need to sort of develop that understanding organically instead of, it, you know, the story being spoon-fed to you, which is, you know, not what they end up doing in archaeology. So I think this is the better format to tell a story like this, I believe.
I agree. I think it's set up to really suit the pacing of archaeology, kind of lots of small, relatively slow reveals within an atmospheric location that even if you just spend some time looking around, will add to your understanding of the story. So it's very much something that's been built for a skill, I think, rather than a quest. And it works.
Yeah,
I
think
I'd say that for any of the sites, but in particular this site, it works really well.
Yeah, I think like my only criticism about like how the sites are laid out in general over the skill, and that's not necessarily a criticism of Everlight in the story, but more, you know, right now there's a lot of back and forth going on, and I would have liked if they had, you know, made it more of sort of a staircase, right, where, you know, like I like that Infernal Source, you sort of end at 70, but like from that point onwards, like I'm right now at a point, well, I just finished Stormguard, but like all the different sites have their stories going on right now. And I know that most of them don't resolve until like deep into like post 99. So it would have been nice, I think, to put the start and end points of the sites closer together and sort of stagger the sites a bit better. But, you know, it's a bit nitpicky, I admit that.
Yeah, I mean, if that's all you have to complain about, that's pretty good.
Right?
Tanis, any thoughts before we move on?
No, I appreciate this site. I haven't gotten to the workings of it like you guys thought. I'm actually looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a lot brighter from the way it sounds.
Yeah.
And so that'll be nice. But no, I don't think that I wouldn't want this story told in another way. I'd much rather have it like this, where I can have as much as I want when I want, rather than I'm stuck now doing puzzles for an hour.
and I think that bodes nicely for the way that they're going to be doing some of the story stuff going forward too. So that's good.
I think one final note before we wrap and move on. Going back to what I said about at the start about this being the most tragic site and the saddest one.
Yes.
The main difference between Everlight and the other four sites is that this is a civilian location. Caridet is a fortress. Stormguard is a weapons R&D site. Warforge is a training camp. The Infernal Source is a cultist headquarters that leads down to a portal to another dimension. This is a city. And, you know, obviously there were soldiers here and there were military installations and stuff like that, but it was predominantly the Iceene home. And you can imagine, you know, this is probably busy with families and busy with people who had nothing to do with the fighting. And then Draken comes along and I presume kills everyone.
Yep.
That, to me, is the horrible, tragic core of it.
Yeah, and we got that in the mysteries too. And it's like they start so bright and then they wind up being, you know, some of the most tragic that we've seen.
Yeah, and it kind of, to me, brings home the reality of how horrific the Gold Wars was. This was not a good time to be alive. There were four or five, possibly more, actual corporeal gods stomping around trying to fight for territory. And a lot of people died. Like, a lot of things and people were destroyed in the process, and this is the manifestation of that.
Yeah, not fun. Not fun.
No. Yeah, there was a lot of horror and a lot of death in this particular time, and this site explores that.
All right. I absolutely loved this site. I loved it from the first time I saw it. I loved it as I learned the lore of it. And, you know, just completing it was very, very satisfying. We'll see if anything else tops it. So far, it's my favorite. We'll see what happens with Warforge and Caridet as we get there and complete those. But I think unless there's anything else on Everlight, we can move on to the RS update of the week.
Yep, that's all from me. It is my favorite one at the moment. That might change when I get through Caridet, because I know there's some really exciting stuff coming in the next 10 levels or so. But at the moment, this is my favorite. Like, I'm a very visual gamer. I like things that look pretty.
Yeah, me too. I like my shinies.
This site caters to that very nicely.
All right. Well, not to be undone by Everlight, but we also did have Ninja Strike number 10 this week. Ninja Strike number 10 already. And on the surface, you know, Sirion, you and I were talking about this one. I said, yeah, this is a simple ninja strike. But you said, no, it solves some problems that players were very interested in fixing. And that is, first, crystal chests and player broadcasts. And with player broadcasts, there is now granular control of what you can turn on and turn off for all the various broadcasts out there, and they have a table here showing the broadcasts and the changes that were made this week, and they move some of them around. I'm not going to go through them because this is an exhaustive list, but as per usual, you can go inside your game settings and turn broadcasts off if you don't want to see them, and it's just giving that granular level of choice for these broadcasts. I mean, if you don't want broadcasts from random Joe RuneScaper, you can turn those off. But if you just want your clan and friends broadcasts, there you go.
Yeah, like I agree it's not necessarily like a massive game-changing update, but, you know, I think this... I saw a lot of people sort of complaining about it, that it wasn't much and all that stuff. But to me, this is exactly... This is a perfect example of a ninja strike, you know? It fixes two areas of the game that, you know, could do with some fixing, like they had problems or, you know, just weren't up to date anymore, and they fixed it. I think it's a nice thematic week. Yeah, like, to me, like, what more do people expect from this ninja strike? Like, it comes down to expectations as well. I think a bunch of people were misled by one of the tweets that RuneScape...
Yeah,
folks
thought it was lunar spell changes coming.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a lot of people maybe being a bit disappointed there, or, you know, they expect more from a game update, but you know, it's not the world we live in anymore. And you know, we got some pretty good updates like over the past few weeks already. So you know, I think it's just, you know, I think it's a really good example of a ninja strike, and if we can get one or two of these every month, you know, I'll be happy.
Yeah. Tanis, how does this work for accessibility on you and your client?
This ninja strike?
Yeah.
Like with the, it doesn't have a lot of effect. I mean, if I was relying on visually reading my chat, I could limit it a lot more, and that would be good. Control is always a great thing, but I use things that can help me read, take in the chat auditory. So it doesn't have as big of a bang. But I look at this as kind of like, it's kind of both, right? Like, I don't think this is as big as some of the other ninja strikes. But what I do think is that the people that are irritated by the broadcast system are really irritated by the broadcast system. Like, it really bugs the ever-living crap out of them. So, you know, not every update is going to be huge. Not every update is going to hit me or, you know, what I like. But it's still a good update because yeah. I do know how much it does bug people. Some people, I think, just want to see their own name in the broadcast. And if that's not happening, then they're just mad. But, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, we have things that are disappearing from the broadcast list, like Dragon Full Helmets. Dragon claws, and,
yeah.
Dragon pickaxes,
yeah, which is nice.
Yeah,
that is nice. But you know, I mean, I can see like why people think it's not a big update, but at the same time, I don't have people not been watching, because I do agree with Sirion. Like, we're coming off of some bangers, and we know that there's more to come, and we also know that not every day is going to be huge. So where do you want your weeks that they're not going to be huge?
Yeah.
This was an acceptable week for that, or is it? You know yeah. what I mean? Like,
because we also got the crystal chest changes this week. There's a now toggle to bring your items out in noted form, and you can also bank the items directly from the chest.
Yeah, that's cool.
I love it.
Because I mean, with how many
deposit. That's nice.
Because, I mean, with how many keys we've been accumulating throughout all our training from Grace of the Elves, this is definitely something we need.
How many yeah. keys have you been accumulating, Shane?
I did like 30 the other day.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I did 28.
Wow, I guess you didn't get lucky then, huh?
No, I did
oh,
not.
No.
I did not. Let's dive into
it. Like, the way I look at it is this as well. You know, let's say a new, like, for us it might not be a big deal, but let's say a new player comes into the game and they go into something like the crystal chest, and it's just, you know, the experience isn't great. It feels clunky and old, and you know, that's the kind of stuff that just stands out at that point. And you know, I think what the ninja team is trying to do is take all these low points of the game, you know, and lift them all up to, you know, a better average level, so that like the worst things in the game are fixed and better. And it, you know, it just creates a better game for everyone. And you know, if you're one of those people that never use crystal chests, you know, tough luck. But you know, next Ninja Strike might affect what you are playing. So
yeah, and they also yes. extended it out, because this toggle also works for reward chests, which allows players to bring their items out in noted form if they want.
Ooh.
So from like the
so all boss. All the chests are going to be kind of like the Sylphinheim dungeon one. Then,
yeah, right? Exactly.
Ooh, I like that.
So boss chests and whatnot as well.
Okay, well, that's why I didn't realize it. I don't. I always get killed by bosses.
Yeah,
really
they also remove the animations for smoother opening. Multiplayers can use the chest at the same time as well. The crystal chests. They've also changed some minor balancing with Triskelion keys. You guys ready for this one? The 125 adamant and 750 coal stone spirit drop is now 15 bane stone spirits. and the 40 rune and 320 coal stone spirit is now 5 light and 5 dark Animica stone spirits.
But, I mean, not for nothing, Jagex, but you can just keep, like, is there a button y'all can say, hey, just keep the change? Is it
no,
like,
No. Like, hear me out. At this point, with the act tracks that I've been doing, I actually want Bane and Animica stone spirits.
Okay. Well,
it does feel a bit sucky. You get like 2.
Yeah. Keep in mind, they got to keep these rare because it took months for the economy to stabilize after the mining and smithing rework came out because so many people were hitting these high tier rocks.
I'm not saying you're wrong, and I fully agree, but it's the same as you get like 2 diamonds from like a drop.
Exactly. They add up over time.
They do add up over time, but crystals to scalions are not something you just keep doing over time.
Like, so you want this to be like a big bing wow moment kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Like, and maybe like stone spears are not the right tool to give that, but you know, when I go and get my crystal to scalion, I'm like, oh, I'm excited. Like, one time I got a dragon pickaxe from my Triskelion, right? Like, that was like, really? Oh, wow. I really got a good reward.
Okay.
Getting 2 Baneite Stone Spirit, or 15 Baneite Stone Spirits is like, meh. It just doesn't have the same oomph.
Right. Okay. I can see that. Diana, how do you feel about these changes to the Triskelions? Amongst other things.
Crystal Test and Triskelion is going to be useful for me because of, you know, all the keys we've been getting in archaeology. Yeah. I'm not really fussed about the actual drops because if it's valuable, I'll sell it. If it's not, I'll put it in my bank and forget about it until I run out of money and then I'll sell it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what I appreciate about what you just said is that that's, you know, I want to say the average RuneScape player's way of looking at this. Because all too often, even on the show, sometimes we look at things from the high end, which, you know, we need to also look at the averages too with this, which is important.
Yeah, I'm not really into the whole min-maxing on that side of things. So it's just like, meh, if it gives me money now, I'll get money now. If it's useful, I might keep it.
All right.
Meh, that's it, really.
We also had some changes to Alchemical Hydrix's this week, the Essence of Finality will now appear in the Constitution ability book when filtered. Also, some issues have been resolved with the effect of portable skilling stations was not being triggered by Brooch of the Gods.
That's such a wonderful piece of jewelry.
Yeah.
So you mean that the best thing about it didn't work? That's not good.
I'm still just disappointed with the name. You get all these really cool names, you know, like Luck of the Dwarves and the Grace of the Elves and Ingenuity of the humans, and then you get Brooch of the Gods.
Yeah. Fixed a visual issue that appeared when changing attack style after using the Essence of Finality ability. Other improvements in the general patch notes area. We're moving out of the Ninja Strike now. The Order of Dis and the Infernal Source music tracks will now loop as expected. You can toggle warnings that appear when decanting flask, and you can find this under the Skills and Experience menu in the Herblore section of the Skilling Options. Players can now use movement abilities such as Surge in the Virago, Nex, and Talos instance lobbies. The flowing blood in Daemonheim is no longer stripey. I have no idea.
Love where that, bug fixes like that.
I have no idea where that's referring to, but A-okay.
Gotta love patch notes like that.
You can now progress the You're Not My Real Ma, even when donating more Elder Chronicles than required. An issue has been fixed where the Worn Equipment tab would become persistently unavailable after summoning a pet in Death's office.
Sometimes I just want to know what kind of weird combination of code that caused that to happen.
Well, I got an even better one for you next then. Fixed a bug that caused the report interface to remain open after choosing a reason to report the offending player.
I mean, that I can sort of like understand, you know, some UI events like being broken, but you know, worn equipment and summoning a pet in Death's office, like what? It's like a joke, right? Like what do your worn equipment interface and the Death's office have?
20-year-old code base, always fun.
Yeah. And finally, and for those who are triggered by Pullian Polaris, FPS should no longer rapidly drop while curing a plant at the Livid Farm on Lunar Isle. And that's the patch notes for this week. But, you know, we had our hot issue of the month last month, as we like to call them from time to time, with the Treasure Hunter bug, let's just say. And now this week, it's actually being called the Discounted Treasure Hunter Key in Oddments Exploit. But there's actually an update with this week on September 1st, where Jagex actually took credit for this and admitted that it was their responsibility, and they apologized for it. They summarize it as a cause of two different mechanics, the Oddments discount system and the Loot Duels Treasure Hunter promotion. We erroneously said that this was related to the Traveling Artisan last week because we were hooking it into that. That was not the case. And they said there were unforeseen consequences of this edge case for one of our newer systems, and they fixed it as soon as the problem was found. And they say it's not a bug in the traditional sense. It was a problem that had the potential to be exploited by a small number of players. And they identified just under 7,000 players who purchased keys using Oddments during this time period. Of these, 835 were identified as having purchased excessive amount of keys between 500 and 2,000 with Oddments during that window and were clearly taking advantage of the exploit. These accounts received a 72-hour ban for bug abuse minor. 61 accounts were identified as either having purchased an excessive amount of keys with accompanying XP gain, over 20 million XP, or having over 2,000 keys with Oddments along with an unbalanced key spend ratio. These people were given 14-day bans for bug abuse, moderate, and four further accounts have been banned for 14 days pending further investigation. Now, they say because this was unintended on their part, the actions are more lenient than those would have been typically implemented for bug abuse, and the 85% who tested the mechanic rather than abusing it are not subject to any further action. We again would like to highlight the impact that this had on the game economy was minimal. And this was, of course, hot-fixed at 7:10 p.m. British summertime on Monday, August 24th.
I mean, I was kind of convinced that, you know, they would limit these bans to, you know, known excessive plays in the first place. Like I didn't really think that, you know, it was as big of an issue as many people made it out to be.
Yeah,
When I heard the fuss about it, I thought, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people had been banned, but it's just like, oh, less than 100 got a 14-day ban.
Yeah.
Is that it?
I don't like when they just ban players, tell them it's bug abuse, and then just shed all responsibility off them. I don't like it. I get it. But I can also understand it from the company's perspective, because there's so much that can go wrong if you admit, you know, you're wrong and made a mistake in this and then ban people for using that. So this post and update came quite unexpected to me, but I respect it that they really went out of their way to say, you know, we're wrong, we apologize, and for me that means this issue is done now. They apologized and these things happen. I know these things happen because, you know, these things happen in software. That's just you're never going to get around that. So,
oh, I missed the part where they said the 61 people who were banned for moderate bug abuse also had an XP rollback.
Right.
Yeah. And you know,
I think looking at this post, you know, they took appropriate action to this response, and you know, they apologized. What more do people want? I think we got more than. Honestly, then we
right and you know that they
deserved.
They still took the crap for it, and I was actually surprised that they were able to do this because I thought, you know, if you say this and this is related to a paying system, aren't you opening yourself up to some kind of legal trouble, perhaps?
Yeah, you'd think.
You know, there's going to be some person out there who's going to sue them for something, right?
Well, that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that it has to be every. That's what we always have to come down to. That's what we always have to think about. Like, look, I'm glad they took this approach versus another approach. Had there been like permanent bans, I would probably not be real happy about it at all because I think the responsibility does rest with Jagex on that. But at the same time. I get the line you're walking, but it's unfortunate that you have to walk that line because I just hate it that we're talking about that instead of talking about, like, how do we prevent it? You know what I mean? Like, we could be talking about something else.
Oh, you can bet they had a discussion internally on how to prevent this. Whenever something like that happens, any company worth their – worth what they say will have that kind of
debrief. I don't really accept the, like – them dirty players again.
No, I don't think anybody would have said
that's not I don't accept that either. Like, but like, that is not a tone they were pursuing on purpose, I think. It's sort of a necessity as a company these days, and I totally agree with you. I hate that companies have to be this way, but you know, that's I think that's kind of where we're at. So
all right, I think we can leave that there, and you know, it's good to handle these things in public and do it transparently than not, and you know, that's important. And you know, I think a Jagex of a number of years ago would not have done that and been transparent about it, so that's good. So,
yeah.
All right, let's move on. We do have a listener question this week, a tiny one, but that's okay. Before we do that, though, I'll just remind our listeners about our Patreon page where, you know, if you want to support the podcast, you can do so. For as little as $1 a month, you gain access to an entire back catalog of monthly bits. You get early access to the show notes, and, of course, you help fund the costs of hosting and production of RSBNB Update. You also get to vote in the monthly bits, which our Patreon folks just finished doing, and it ended in a tie. So what this means is that the two options that polled the highest were RuneScape's Graphical Identity and Alternate History Invention Wins Over Prif. We're going to do these two monthly bits back-to-back. So the September one will be Graphical Identity, and the October one will be the Alternate History piece. So we're just going to do that since there was a tie on that. Equal interest in that sake. So look forward to that next week or so. But, you know, Patreon members get full access to the back catalog of those for as little as $1 a month. In addition to everything else, including the ability to come to movie night, come to the round table, and of course, read Inside Update. We also do have another tier, the RSBNB Update VIP tier. For $3 a month, we get a special VIP rank on Discord and a mention on the podcast at the start of the month, and access to high-quality stereo AAC versions of the show. We also do have a $5 a month tier, the RSBNB Update Insider. You'll get a shout-out each and every week on the podcast and gain exclusive access to the outtakes that we use to form the clip show at the end of the year. So if this sounds like your cup of tea, visit patreon.com/RSBNB, just like many other people have. And I'd like to thank some of these people right now, in particular this week. Since it's the start of the month, I'd like to thank Andrew C., Brock H., Cameron, Cass, CGB900, Christian S., Diana, Duramax, Jade Gizmo, JW, James W., Jason S., Jim M., Joe M., John P., Kevin G., Kyle, Nora, Owen L., Rastafa, Ricky A., Samantha R., Steve T., Stabib, the Naked Captain, Lion, Tom V., Zachary K., and Zenth. Thank you all of you for your support. It truly means the world to us. And if you want to check out more of this, just visit patreon.com/rsbnb. And thanks so much, everybody, for making these episodes possible.
Thanks, guys.
All right. So from Sunset Fish this week, in our question segment, with the 20-year anniversary coming up, how would you like to celebrate with Jagex, and how would you like them to celebrate with us?
So hear me out, okay, right? Like, so yes. People always say that the old days are better. So what if we just took like an old backup of like, let's say 2007 or something like that, and like spin it up on a separate server, and then people can play that and see how...
Sirion. Sirion, I hate to break it to you.
All right. So, what about you guys?
You got the salt out of your system?
Yeah.
20 years. Bloody hell.
I want RuneScape Hero Walk. I want a new park area set up. A big, dedicated park to this and what you would do. And I don't know where you'd put this. You'd have to find a spot for it. Maybe it could be instanced. I'd just like a walk that you could take. And, you know, the first time you do it for the anniversary event, you would go on this walk and it would be guided for you. It would take you nice and slow. There'd be some of those nice little graphical cutscenes that we've seen in Desperate Measures and Desperate Times. And it would effectively take you through RuneScape's history, both, you know, in-world and out-of-world over these 20 years, showcasing the various milestones, you know, like the move from Devious Mud to RS Classic to RS2 to HD and then RS3 and beyond to NXT. Also talking about, you know, the key lore milestones throughout all the years, key quests, you know, maybe some key tidbits here about, you know, when did we hit 200 million players? When did, you know, X skill come out and so on and so forth. Just, you know, milestones like that. Make it like a walk that your character can take through a park and, you know, maybe have some kind of statues around there commemorating the various aspects of it. And just have it be, in effect, a shrine to RuneScape player history. And, you know, maybe an instanced area is the best way to go for it. I'm not thinking anything too grandiose, you know, not, you know, archaeology level in terms of art aspect, just, you know, a map square with maybe some, you know, entities that are there, some NPCs, a couple of statues, and then some cutscenes.
Cool.
I'd like another thing like Gower Quest. That was the 50th anniversary thing.
Talk about something like that.
I would love another quest that, or another bit of content like that, that just revels in the silliness of RuneScape and is a celebration and something fun and, you know, makes references to stuff that's happened like in the past 20 years and makes fun of itself and is light and silly and, you know, you have a drink and play the stupid quest and laugh about it with your friends. I'd love something like that.
Right on.
Yeah, I think it's really important that, you know, RuneScape has always been, in my opinion, much more lighthearted than most other MMOs. So, you know, I think like, whatever it is, it should be a celebration of that identity, that RuneScape identity.
So, here's mine, right? But we can't do it this year. We're not celebrating 20 years because 2020 never happened. We're going to celebrate 21 years, which is a much more important birthday in the States because that's when we get the drink, right? I know all you Europeans are like, we've been doing this for years. But no, well, we make a big deal because we're like, we're going to drink! And we get hammered, right? Well, what I'm saying is, on the eve of the 21st, we hold RuneFest, and we all go there, and we get blitzed together, and here's the best part, on the day of RuneFest, they release a new quest that is in the spirit of one small favor, but it traces every era and every important character all the way through the 20 years. And you can mirror it with like some kind of like walk around kind of game at RuneFest with that. Yeah?
Yeah? That would be great.
I know there are people who want a sequel to One Small Favor.
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of people hate One Small Favor, and I'm not going to say it's like a great quest, but I think it's a great symbol of the silliness that's RuneScape.
It's iconic.
And how...
it's a RuneScape quest.
Yes.
Yeah, like how it doesn't take itself serious, and that's...
for the 15-year anniversary, we had...
Was Gower Quest.
The Gower Quest and the...
Jeez, that's 5 years ago?
And the documentary.
Oh my goodness.
Where did it go?
I thought that was 18. I thought that was 2 years ago.
No, that was 2016.
Oh, Josh.
So, I mean, you got to top that in some way, but...
I think a sequel that's in the same spirit of One Small Favor would be great.
I mean, Hans has to be the protagonist of that. I mean, one other thing that I think, you know, when it first came out, the thing I quite liked was the loyalty system as well. I think it's great if there was some way of tying that into, you know, I've done a lot of things in my, like, I've been there for a lot of things in the history of RuneScape. Like, I don't know. I can't even come up with any examples right now. Like the introduction of EOC, like some of the earlier quests. Like, I know that, you know, this show has been around since the release of Slayer.
Yeah, I'm definitely, like, going to do something for this.
When is the 20th anniversary? Is it January?
January 4th.
Yeah. But I kind of just want a sticker book. That's what I want. You know, like an in-game item that has all these stickers or pictures.
And we know they can do that because we have that in the archaeology journal.
Yeah, like, that's what I want. Go around, going back to all these places. Like, it could be part of this. It could be this quest, really. And just, you know, collect these mementos of, you know, when I was there. I want to take selfies with all the people.
God.
Of
course you want to take this. The friggin' selfie.
I want this to be the World Guardian's big day out. That's what I want it to be.
There we go. There's your name for it.
World Guardians Big Day Out. I love that.
I don't know about selfies, the past, but we definitely got a show title.
Yeah. What about you, Diana?
I've already said mine.
Oh, whoops.
20th anniversary quest in the same spirit of Gower Quest.
Okay, fair enough. Well then, I think we can move on then. Thank you, Sunset Fish, for that question. It's going to be a big one. I'll have to go back in time and, you know, pull out some relics from people who played RS Classic, and I think I know just the people I want on that show. So
RS Classic was great.
Yeah, it really was. It really was.
It was great. It was awful, but it was also great.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to tech news in that way, and things that are also great. I'm going to get to live out my dream in a number of years going forward. Last week on Friday, Elon Musk demoed his Neuralink device on pigs. And the idea behind this is that this Neuralink is going to be able to read brain activity and transfer it out into a data format on a computer. And granted, at this point, it's able to just, you know, for example, in the demo they did when he was showing it off, when the pig went for food, there was a blip on the radar, so to speak, with that. And obviously, there's nothing to show today in terms of what it can do, but they're hoping that what this will be able to do in the future is, for one example, be able to help people who have Alzheimer's or dementia and allow them to remember without having their actual memories. The idea being is that you'd be able to save a memory or something like that. And this is where it gets a little bit creepy, this could effectively be a brain internet device where you'd be able to control the internet or pull up data from some form of futuristic search engine just by thinking about it. And for those wondering what this is going to be a neural implant that sits on the base of your brain, which burrows a little bit into your skull. It's a 3mm by 5mm device.
Burrows, huh?
You know, I'm a big fan of technology and new technology, I would say. But yeah, I know. It's, for me, this is one step too far. You know, it's, you know, we are concerned right now about the level of privacy we have when going on the internet, which is, you know, I can pull out a few cables and turn off a few devices, and you know, I'm disconnected and all good. But you know, this to me, it might be sort of a momentum thing. Like maybe our children and children's children will think nothing of it. But
I'd line up for this.
To me, like, it's an absolute, you know, it feels like an invasion of you know, it's, I don't want to say holy, but, you know, there's sort of, yeah, I put the line at my skin. Let's just keep it that way.
It's the whole thing where if what can someone sell off you?
Yeah.
And if it's collecting this kind of data from you, who is it going to be sold to?
Yeah.
Because it will be sold.
The first trials will be in patients with severe spinal cord injuries, by the way.
It also strikes me as someone who doesn't really understand how the brain works.
Good point. Good point.
Like, Elon Musk is obviously a very he's a salesperson. He's very well connected and he has a lot of money. I can't comment on his intelligence because I've heard various conflicting things. He's a very shrewd businessman. I'll give him that. But he does strike me as someone who possibly isn't the best kind of person to comment on.
You know what
a very difficult and like neuroscience is a fledgling field.
Yeah.
Like, we know nothing about the brain.
I want to just...
This strikes me as someone who wants to say something cool to get funding, but he doesn't actually understand what he's doing because no one does.
Yeah, and I just want to comment on this. You know, he was mentioned numerous times in Star Trek Discovery as being, you know, one of the great people of the 21st century, that there was a school named after him. And, you know, the funniest part about this is that the person who praised Elon Musk in Star Trek Discovery was from the Mirror Universe, of all things.
Well, which, if you're not a Star Trek nerd, because it's a wrong assumption that everybody is, the Mirror Universe is basically a universe where humanity is fundamentally malicious.
Oh. It's a mirror universe. Wait, what's a mirror?
I mean, Elon Musk is basically a supervillain. He is absolutely a supervillain. If you're looking at this from an outside perspective.
But this is a double edge, like every other important technology that we ever develop. I mean, it's the same as atomic energy in that regard, that if you think about what this could do for people that are paraplegic or something, and maybe not right now, but down the road.
And anybody who's had it.
So you can lead to the other. You know, the other.
I mean, absolutely. And as soon as anyone shows me that that's possible, I will support it.
Yeah,
but this doesn't show anything. It shows that a pig's brain fires when it touches things.
Exactly.
I
just want to say one thing. Anybody who has had a family member who has suffered from Alzheimer's will understand the draw of this.
See, I've had family members suffer from Alzheimer's, and I don't see how it could help them.
Well, if everybody could record all their memories as they were going through life, and that's one thing that he said they'd like.
But how would that help the person with Alzheimer's?
They'd be able to recall them.
That's not how Alzheimer's works. That's not what Alzheimer's does, in my experience of it, anyway, or in my experience of having family members have it.
Well, my experience
is a physical degeneration,
right? Like, and not being able to.
Recording the memories would surely help the people who are dealing with the person who has Alzheimer's and, you know, who are, you know, maybe they're preparing to, you know, pass away and you've got these lovely memories of them. That, yeah, for sure. But how would it relieve the symptoms of Alzheimer's? How would it help someone remember who they are? I don't see that yet. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but I'm waiting on better evidence.
He also says he wants to help people eventually achieve what he calls AI symbiosis, allowing the brain to merge.
Supervillain.
Artificial intelligence. See,
but what if you could? I mean, we are kind of like glancing over. This could be like, if you can download your consciousness, you're looking at immortality. Like, forget
God,
remembering
who wants that?
You can go,
Christ,
I'm me. I do.
Tana's secret... Tana's secret supervillain confirmed.
I'm already aiming for 120. Right, this will help me.
The RSB&B update scoop.
I don't know.
No, but like I think for me, and you know, there's a certain pessimism I've developed around technology. You know,
yeah, me too.
If you think about, okay, I think we can all agree that Facebook, to some extent, is pretty nefarious, right? But if you think about the fundamental mission of what Facebook started as, it is to connect people that may not be able to connect people, like that might not be able to meet, like physically, or you know, it is a social network in many ways, as in, you know, it was an enhancement of, you know, our social interactions, which there is nothing wrong with wanting to do that. Like, I think the main mission of Facebook is not a nefarious one. And I think if you look at a lot of technologies, they all came with a promise of, you know, great and amazing new things. And they can all do that. But apparently we as humanity are also really good at take every invention that we ever created and using it for bad things. And as we become more intelligent and make more powerful inventions, the consequences of that are going to become bigger as well. And for something like this, the consequences are, like, for
we
all
don't
the
know
current
what they
technologies, for all the current technologies, we can still throw them out of a window to some extent. Like, we are not going to die if we disconnect from the internet, say. But, you know, this is getting to the point where if we reach symbiosis, like, symbiosis literally gets us to a point where we can't live without, and then people start using this stuff maliciously, you know, that's nightmare material there for me.
Yeah,
that's sort of what
know,
the angle I'm
you're
taking.
Dealing with the Borg Collective in that case. Another Star Trek reference.
Theron, it's almost like we start off with good intentions, and it's not the technology that is good or bad, but just once you have to make a buck on it, it's almost like it corrupts everything. Like all these, it just corrupts everything that we do. It's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of
if it was to go anywhere, it would have to be with. Basically, I think people who go into tech have to be taught more about ethics.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not
absolutely.
That not ethics in the sense of this is right and this is wrong, but ethics is a philosophical field.
Yes.
And it should be compulsory for anyone who wants to make money out of tech because it's just far too important
ethics
to leave.
Ethics and computer science, fledgling field.
But
also, speaking of a dollar, the new NVIDIA graphics cards, the GeForce RTX 3080 series, has been announced to be launching on September 17th, they bill themselves as being twice as fast as the previous generation, which we'll have to wait and see how that holds up, because it's been ages since we've seen something double in performance here.
Moore's Law is dead.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, they say it's going to be $700 US for this card. They're also going to be having an even more powerful one, the 3090. And that's going to be more expensive than the $700 version, but for everyone else, there's the 3070 series as well. And, you know, we're in this really interesting spot, I feel, with the graphics card technologies, because NVIDIA at this point is so far ahead of AMD that you have to really ask the question, is NVIDIA putting out their true showing, because it's been ages since AMD has been able to meet or exceed NVIDIA. They meet their mid-tier stuff really well, but on the high end, it's just 100% NVIDIA. And all these cards also go for crypto mining as well, so they're going to be even more stupid expensive than the list price on them. But, you know, we are looking at the next generation of NVIDIA graphics cards here.
You know, for all we're saying about Moore's Law being dead, you know, I continue to be amazed by graphics cards specifically. Like, when I went to uni, which is not that long ago, like maybe like 5 years, like what I was taught in school is, you know, you can't do physically accurate lightning models based on ray tracing in real time. It's too expensive. We simulate it, we fake it, and we make it look good. That was 5 years ago.
And here's the second generation of ray tracing cards.
And here's the second generation of ray tracing cards, which it's absolutely baffling to me how fast that has moved and the difference it has made. And You know, it is very likely that in maybe like a couple of years from now, like ray tracing in games is the standard, which it's magical to me. Like I know more than the average person about.
Can you just give us a quick 30-second summary on what ray tracing is? I think we did it before on the podcast, but let's do it again.
Oh yeah,
30 seconds. 30 seconds.
30 seconds on the clock. Ray tracing is normally we see things because light reaches us from a light source into our eyes. Ray tracing is trying to simulate that by doing it backwards, by shooting rays from our virtual eyes and see if they hit a light source, because all the laws of physics related to light are symmetrical.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Nice. Very nice. Well done.
So it just makes it, it's just going to effectively make our games and whatnot look more realistic, way more realistic.
Yes, because normal shading models, we look at a pixel and we calculate the angle between the light, the surface, and the direction to our eye. And we use some smart formulas to simulate the rough brightness of that point on the screen. But we can't do things as reflections. You know, in real life, you know, all objects reflect light. Some are like shiny. You might have like multiple reflective materials and get like reflections of reflections. You know, we've all seen it. Like, it all feels very natural. But calculating this all in real time is really expensive. So we fake it. And by doing ray tracing, you can, in theory, have reflections of reflections of reflections of reflections. And, you know, it all starts looking more realistic because we have been trained all our life in the real world. So we know what realistic lighting looks like, which we can much better simulate in these new models.
Yeah. Now, speaking of what these graphics cards are going to be able to do, it's thought that the RTX 3080, the baseline high-end model, will be CPU bottlenecked unless you're running at 1440p or 4K, unless you're in some specific games, which we'll talk about later. And this raises a question of, you know, who exactly needs the 3080? And we'll just have to wait and see until the benchmarks arrive on that. But I want to move on to our last piece of tech news right now, because this is something that many of us who took our first step into the digital world in the late 90s and early 2000s here were going to be aware of, and that's the Nokia 3310. That's that old brick of a phone that was many people's first cell phone, turned 20 years old this week.
And they probably all still work.
I mean, people are complaining about nuclear waste and plastic as like waste, but you know, I think there's like containers full of these things that just can't be broken apart.
They just won't Kansas die.
That's like a secret vault under Antarctica where we just put all these phones because we don't know what else to do with them, right?
They are called bricks. Maybe that's what people are throwing.
September 1st, 2000 was when this phone launched, and it had that iconic Nokia ringtone. And, you know, it had a small LCD screen on it. And this was when phones were phones.
When they
you sounded very old when you said that.
Somebody.
I know. I didn't have this one. I had one of their flip phones, but I knew people who had this one. And, you know,
I had that one.
One thing I never understood.
I know people who have and use this today, like, still in use.
Burner phone?
The original Nokia 3310.
They also have tinfoil, right? Because they are not on the
fridge. Live on these things is still amazing. It runs way longer than your best high-end smartphone new out of the box.
Go figure.
One thing I want to know is, how did people text back in the day before full QWERTY keyboards?
Difficulty. You just learn. You could do it with one hand. Not looking at it, you just learnt where the keys are and where the, you know, the buttons, which one you had to do. It was very slow.
I at some point got a phone which had like one of these suggestion engines, so you didn't have to like double tap numbers. You would just tap the numbers and it would automatically figure out which words fit.
I had something like that.
It was called D9 back in the day with a whole keyboard.
And think of how many RuneScape subscriptions were bought off these, because pay by SMS was big back in the day too.
Oh, bless.
Gosh, yeah, good old times. I kind of miss these phones.
We're longing for the good old days, as they say.
You old fart, miss these phones. A lot of you.
No, I miss my iPhone 4.
Why?
Well, you have reason for accessibility.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't miss my butter churn. I mean,
hey,
you know?
Hand churned butter is some of the best butter you can have. Have you ever churned butter?
No, I can't say
that. I have.
But you don't have to, right? You do have grocery stores with, like, I don't know, butter.
Yeah.
Stuff, right?
But there's just nothing as good as, you know, fresh baked bread out in the stone oven and hand churned butter.
If Shane sounded old when he said that, you know, when phones were just phones, that just got superseded by this.
Right. I, back in the day, went on, I think it was, you know, we came home at the end of each day, but we went on effectively a 3-day field trip to this place here where you would do as they did in the 1800s. And of that included starting fires by rubbing two sticks together, milking cows, baking bread, and of course making butter. Oh, and candles.
Oh, but you didn't? Did you do blacksmithing?
No.
Oh man, that's fun.
That's been on my bucket list for a long, long time.
It's really cool. It's really hard. But it's
I think we just took the show from the 2020s to the 1820s here.
Yeah, right. That's where we are at now. We're like 2020? No. Let's go back to 1820.
I would live in the 1820s.
Siren's like, screw technology. We're going back to 1820s. Shane's like, yeah, I'm cool with that, guys. I'll show you how to churn some butter.
Can't wait to die at the age of 25 from an infected tooth.
Oh no, I saw dental kits from that era too. They made it work.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, they did. All right, let's move on. Our skill of the month for September are summoning and fishing. These start on the 10th of the month, so you have 1 week to sign up from this point of us recording. I don't know who wants to spend money, but if you do, summoning is there. And if you just want to relax and do fishing, that's there as well. So let's begin with the achievements then.
Sounds great. So we have Isarup with 120 Herblore on September 2. Lord Gimli got 99 Hunter on the 1st of September. Mind got 120 Prayer on the 1st of September. And also on the 1st of September, we have Stinky Pete 22 getting 99 Smithing. Well done.
We have Doc Hawk with 99 Invention on August 31st. Jag 3 Dagster with 99 Mining, also on August 31st. Adani with 120 Farming on August 30th. And Legion 1943 with 99 Archaeology on August 30th.
All right, picking up on the 30th, we have Lithius with 99 Constitution. Doc Hawk again on the 29th with 99 Runecrafting. Sethroth with 99 Fletching. And Thieves with 120 Agility on the 29th.
Oh, boy. That's a painful one.
Wonder if that was Boots.
I hope so. But continuing on, we got Stinky Pete 22 with 99 Fishing on August 28th. Doc Hawk with 99 Woodcutting on August 27th. Pop O with 120 Mining on August 27th, and Rastafa with 120 Fletching on August 27th.
Whew. Nicely done.
Nice, guys.
Nicely done. All right. So we're going to move into our pick of the week here, and this is a joint pick of the week between Sirion and myself. This week's pick of the week is Microsoft Flight Simulator, available on Xbox Game Pass and Steam. the newest iteration in Microsoft's flight simulators, going back to the late 1980s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. This, yeah.
We've been having fun flying around. You've been keeping to the smaller things. I've started with the A320, Airbus A320, toured around my city. You've been touring around your country with this. It is just so stunning what you can do with this. But you're gonna need a pretty good computer.
Yeah, it really is. Like, it's so funny. Like, if this were any other game, I would absolutely burn it for like how horribly optimized it is. You know, it's full with bugs. You know, it there's so much criticism you could have on the game, and you wouldn't be wrong. But you know, if you look at the technical achievement that they have reached with this game, like mapping the entire world, generating 3D, you know, geometry and buildings to sort of like to the point where, you know, I zoomed in on my house and it looked nothing alike, but you know, from the top I could navigate the route I was cycling from home to school, like by the road, like that. The accuracy to do that is there, and that is already really stunning. And you know, the game looks really pretty. It my hardware has been like on fire.
Oh,
like,
you think yours has? I've crashed because I don't have enough RAM, I think.
Yeah.
You have 16, you know, like, right?
Hmm? Yeah, I have 16 gigabytes. So you know, it's like, it's not a smooth running game for my hardware. I think you're gonna need one of these fancy new NVIDIA cards to start getting some really good like performance out of the game. Like, this game, like, it, people still play FSX, right? Which is, you know, what year? 2002, I think?
No.
It's old, though.
Yeah.
You know, people still play fairly old flight sim games.
2006.
Like, okay, fair enough.
And, you know, that one was very casual and to an extent was superseded by the various versions of X-Plane 9, 10, and 11 for people who wanted accurate simming. Mm-hmm. But this new Microsoft version takes that level of realism, combines it with what I think so far seems pretty accurate, though there are a few bugs here and there, and lowers the barrier to entry on it to the point where, Tanis, you've even been flying around.
Yeah, no, I it has some great assistance options, which everyone can use, but they're especially useful in the, you know, for accessibility. And I'm not like, and you can really like customize it. I was reading, you know, like I'd read an article on the Can I Play That, which kind of gave me just enough where I'm like, it wasn't apples to apples, but it gave me enough to go, well, I can try it. And then I'm like, wait a minute, I found the Game Pass. And then I'm like, oh, we're definitely trying it. And what I want to tell people is, like, don't think that don't let accessibility of the game, like, get in the way of trying the game, because more than likely you'll be able to play it. And I try to find that sweet spot of, like, you know, like, I don't let it bounce off the ground or something. Like, I will crash, but at the same time, I give myself a little bit of leniency when it comes to, like, my altitude and stuff like that, because I do have trouble with the dials. And it depends on the aircraft, on how well I can see it when I, you know, hit down, stuff like that.
Yeah, and to
a wonderful game.
And to that extent, I start all my aircrafts from dark, and, you know, I follow the checklists, too. So there's different levels that you can take it.
I do own FSX and I played some of it, but you know, I've always been sort of, you know, I got stuck flying, or you know, I didn't really have the patience to move up and get better at this game. But you know, this a game, it's been very accessible, like even like to me, and it has inspired me to learn a lot about, you know, aircraft systems, navigation systems. I'm having a lot of fun doing more instrument-based flying, which means, you know, I get a lot to, like, get to be frustrated with all the autopilot controls and all that stuff. But, you know, it's been I found it super interesting, and it for me, it hits that same the same nerve as say playing Euro Truck Simulator or even Elite Dangerous. You know, these are my zen games. I just go and fly. You know, it's just, to me, it's a form of relaxation.
Have you done much with the challenges? Those have been some of my favorite.
I have not.
No, I haven't touched those at all. I've just gone into
those are fun. Okay, yeah, like I've enjoyed doing different, you know.
I'm sort of scared. I think I'm not a very good pilot, so I'm sort of scared going into the challenges and being confronted about how bad I am. Like, I just want to,
dude.
You know,
I'm blind. You're good, dude. If I can set it down, you're probably okay.
Feel now, I have to live with the fact that a blind person can fly better than me. So maybe.
Oh no!
Out of curiosity, what kind of control schemes do you use? You are keyboard and mouse, or
I use an Xbox controller.
I do use an Xbox controller, which isn't like, it's super sensitive, and there's like a few awkward things.
I haven't tried it, but it seems like the exact kind of game that would suit a HOTAS.
Oh yes.
And I've been considering investing in one for Elite.
Suit a witch.
So. Kind of a joystick controller.
Yeah.
Microsoft actually unveiled a replica flight stick that is the same flight stick, modeled after the same flight stick used in the Airbus airplanes.
See, because I've got some experience flying, you know, I've got basically like a quarter of a pilot's license, so I have got some experience of flight controls. So,
give this a try. I'd like to. Do you have Game Pass?
I think I do, somewhere.
Yeah,
I guess somewhere, possibly.
You're like gonna pick us up for RuneFest, right?
We do have a regular flight.
Someone in Time Quest
from Farnborough.
Yeah,
Airport.
We have a plan for this already. Just stay
someone
tuned.
Time Quest does actually have a pilot's license.
Yeah, that's Draz.
I can't remember who, but
Draz.
Is it Draz? It's probably Draz. Yeah. But yeah, it looks like a really interesting game, and you're right, Siren. Like, technically, it's such an achievement.
It is. It really
what
is.
What they've managed
like,
to create.
This game is like a lot of games that come out these days. You know, people will play them for the next 2 months, basically, and then like they're on to the next thing. But simulator games are very different. Like, this game will be around for the next 10, 15 years. So
a lot of people play flight sim games just like for the same reason you do. It's just to chill out.
Yeah,
and that's got an enduring appeal.
Yes, and some people take it really serious and, you know, want to go as realistic as possible. I don't think I'll ever go that far, but you know, it's just chill and nice, and I find it super educational. Like, this game has actually made me want to get my real PPL in real life. I've also looked up the costs for that, and maybe I need to reconsider. The Game Pass is much cheaper, but you know, I found it educational as well. It's super interesting to learn about all these flight systems. Like, it's real. Like, it's not fully realistic. Like, there's a lot of people complaining about, you know, all the buttons are wrong or it's too easy to start up a plane. But like, it is realistic enough for me to have to look up things and learn about aircraft systems, which I think is the perfect balance. And over time, people are going to write mods with your super realistic aircraft that
I'm waiting for a 777.
Add like a Spitfire to it or add a Tiger Moth.
And the aerodynamic system. We haven't even talked about the aerodynamic system that is super impressive. Like, I know how much math is involved with that. The fact that they can do that 30 times per second, every second, and simulate the weather. And, you know, I was flying the other day, and suddenly there was turbulence.
Yeah, and did you feel it in your controller?
Yes! What? Yeah. Like, they can simulate the airflows to the point that they can simulate turbulence?
Oh yeah, first time I took off, I almost got knocked off the runway because of wind.
Like, that's amazing.
Well, that's Microsoft Flight Simulator. We know what Sirion and I have been up to, but we'll come back to that. Tanis, what you been up to this week?
You know, I haven't done much on RuneScape. I've done a little bit of energy on the junior account, but I've been playing. Dude, Game Pass, man, come on. Like, they did this thing, like, I don't know, how long has the PC version of that been out? Because
about a year
I just
and a half.
Now found out about it, and
It's still in beta, isn't it?
I'm like, wow. Yeah, it's still in beta, but I'm like, I get this many games for this amount? You're kidding me.
Best Game Pass game is Best Game Pass game is Halo Master Chief Collection.
See, I already had that one. Yeah, so that was kind of a bummer. But I did get the Europa. I got Europa 4 again, so I'm like, I'm going to learn how to do this, and I'm going to come take Shane's lunch money. And then... So, yeah, all kinds of stuff. Oh, a train simulator. I got that. I've been playing with that, too. So if
you're
planes are too complicated, you get the train.
Talk about badly optimized games, though. But yeah, no, I've been having a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
All right. So. How about you, Diana?
I've been doing a lot of archaeology. Like, a lot of archaeology. I don't think I've ever skilled as hard as I've skilled in last week.
Take
just to get this 105
now.
Today. No, I've got to get up to 110 now.
Woo! All right.
For Coronet and Warforge. I've been playing a lot on mobile, actually. I finally caved and had a go at playing on mobile, and I've been very impressed by it.
Good.
Good. It's been nice to do kind of in the background.
All right.
But yeah, that's it for me.
Sirion.
I'm probably going to play Hitman this weekend.
Ooh. Sirion, aside from Flight Simulator?
Good. Well, I felt I had to bring something to this what have you done last week instead of just, you know, pretending I do have a life. I finished Stormguard finally in the last week. Really nice, really enjoyed finally getting up there. It was a bit of a disappointment. There's not actually that much to do, but no, it's
good. You unlocked
good.
Ancient it's Invention.
I unlocked Ancient Invention. I threw a bunch of money at that and got a nice few perks. I've never really been into like all that min-maxing of the invention perks, so you know, it wasn't a massive milestone for me, but I like the closure finishing a site gives in archaeology. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to like especially Warforged and Caradet, but you know, I got Everlight to unlock as well. So yeah, I've been grinding away the past few days just to start getting towards 99. That's going to be the big next milestone.
Then after that, it's going to be building the Matic of Time and Space.
Yes, or the outfit, or there's so many unlocks at 99.
First.
I'm not going to have all the crow notes.
Yeah, getting the outfit's quite easy. Like, I need to get my Matic of Time and Space still, or Space and Time, or whatever. But
yeah,
I
found
broke,
it such a big
so
boost.
I can't even afford a Dragon Matic anymore.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
I need to save up for that again.
Maybe the Bank of Shane will help you out with that.
Oh, we'll see. I might beg Clan Quest for funds, but we'll see. We'll see.
All right. As for me, archaeology as well, you know, it's still kicking. It's still going. I hit 107 after restoring about 35 of the artifacts needed for the constituency parts of Red Rum 2. So I have lots
very
to
nice.
Do when I get to 110. I think that's when the fourth artifact of Red Rum 2 unlocks, but that's what I've been up to on RS aside from the flight simulator. So with that being said, that's it for this episode of RSBNB Update. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next week for another episode. If you want to subscribe, check it out at update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. Perfect thing to do because it just ensures you get all the podcasts as they arrive and you don't miss an episode, which you're not going to want to do. So that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of RSBNB Update. Take care, everyone.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye-bye.